The first measure of Alexander was to build a pier from the mainland to the island, a dam which remains to this day. And on this, as it came close to the walls of Tyre, he set up his towers and battering rams. Against the walls he also moored ships in which towers and rams were erected. The Tyrians used fire ships against this flotilla and made sorties from their two harbours. In a big surprise raid that they made on the Cyprian ships, they were caught and badly mauled. Many of their ships were rammed, and one big galley of 5 banks of oars and one of 4 were captured outright. Finally, a breach in the walls was made, and the Macedonians, clambering up the debris from their ships, stormed the city. The siege had lasted 7 months. Gaza held out for 2. In each case there was a massacre, the plundering of the city, and the selling of the survivors into slavery. Then, towards the end of 332 BC, Alexander entered Egypt, and the command of the sea was assured. Greece, which all this while had been wavering in its policy, decided now at last that it was on the side of Alexander, and the council of the Greek states at Corinth voted its captain general a golden crown of victory. From this time onward, the Greeks were with the Macedonians. The Egyptians also were with the Macedonians, but they had been for Alexander from the beginning. They'd lived under Persian rule for nearly 200 years, and the coming of Alexander meant for them only a change of masters, on the whole a change for the better. The country surrendered without a blow. Alexander treated its religious feelings with extreme respect. He unwrapped no mummies, as Cambyses had done. He took no liberties with Apis, the sacred bull of Memphis. Here, in great temples, and upon a vast scale, Alexander found the evidence of a religiosity mysterious and irrational to remind him of the secrets and mysteries that had entertained his mother and impressed his childhood. During his 4 months in Egypt, he flirted with religious emotions. He was still a very young man, we must remember, divided against himself. The strong sanity he inherited from his father had made him a great soldier. The teaching of Aristotle had given him something of the scientific outlook upon the world. He had destroyed Tyre. In Egypt, at one of the mouths of the Nile, he now founded a new city, Alexandria, to replace that ancient city of trade. To the north of Tyre, near Issus, he founded a second port, Alexandretta. Both of these cities flourished to this day, and for a time Alexandria was perhaps the greatest city in the world. The sites, therefore, must have been wisely chosen. But also Alexander had the unstable emotional imaginativeness of his mother, and side by side with such creative work he indulged in religious adventures. The gods of Egypt took possession of his mind. He travelled 400 miles to the remote oasis of the Oracle of Ammon. He wanted to settle certain doubts about his true parentage. His mother had inflamed his mind by hints and vague speeches of some deep mystery about his parentage. Was so ordinary a human being as Philip of Macedon really his father? For nearly 400 years, Egypt had been a country politically contemptible, overrun now by Ethiopians, now by Assyrians, now by Babylonians, now by Persians. As the indignities of the present became more and more disagreeable to contemplate, the past and the other world became more splendid to Egyptian eyes. It's from the festering humiliations of peoples that arrogant religious propagandas spring. To the triumphant, the downtrodden can say, "It's naught in the sight of the true gods." So the son of Philip of Macedon, the master general of Greece, was made to feel a small person amidst the gigantic temples, and he had an abnormal share of youth's normal ambition to impress everybody. How gratifying, then, for him to discover presently that he was no mere successful mortal, not one of these modern, vulgar, Greekish folk, but ancient and divine, the son of a god, the Pharaoh god, son of Ammon-Ra. Already in a previous chapter, we've given a description of that encounter in the desert temple. Not altogether was the young man convinced. He had his moments of conviction. He had saner phases when the thing was almost a jest. In the presence of Macedonians and Greeks, he doubted if he was divine. When it thundered loudly, the ribald Aristarchus could ask him, "Won't you do something of the sort, O son of Zeus?" But the crazy notion was nevertheless present henceforth in his brain, ready to be inflamed by wine or flattery. Next spring, 331 BC, he returned to Tyre, and marched thence round towards Assyria, leaving the Syrian desert on his right. Near the ruins of forgotten Nineveh he found a great Persian army that had been gathering since the Battle of Issus, awaiting him. It was another huge medley of contingents, and it relied for its chief force upon that now antiquated weapon, the war chariot. Of these, Darius had a force of 200, and each chariot had scythes attached to its wheels and to the pole and body of the chariot. There seemed to have been 4 horses to each chariot, and it will be obvious that if one of those horses was wounded by javelin or arrow, that chariot was held up. The outer horses acted chiefly as buffers for the inner wheel horses. They were hitched to the chariot by a single outside trace, which could be easily cut away, but the loss of one of the wheel horses completely incapacitated the whole affair. Against broken footmen or a crowd of individualist fighters, such vehicles might be formidable, but Darius began the battle by flinging them against the cavalry and light infantry. Few reached their objective, and those that did were readily disposed of. There was some manoeuvring for position. The well-drilled Macedonians moved obliquely across the Persian front, keeping good order. The Persians, following this movement to the flank, opened gaps in their array. Then suddenly the disciplined Macedonian cavalry charged at one of these torn places and smote the center of the Persian host. The infantry followed close upon their charge. The center and left of the Persians crumpled up. For a while, the light cavalry on the Persian right gained ground against Alexander's left, only to be cut in pieces by the cavalry from Thessaly, which by this time had become almost as good as its Macedonian model. The Persian forces ceased to resemble an army. They dissolved into a vast multitude of fugitives, streaming under great dust clouds and without a single rally across the hot plain towards Arbela. Through the dust and the flying crowd rode the victors, slaying and slaying, until darkness stayed the slaughter. Darius led the retreat. Such was the Battle of Arbela. It was fought on October the 1st, 331 BC. We know its date so exactly because it's recorded that 11 days before it began, the soothsayers on both sides had been greatly exercised by an eclipse of the moon. Darius fled to the north into the country of the Medes. Alexander marched on to Babylon. The ancient city of Hammurabi, who had reigned 1,700 years before, and of Nebuchadnezzar the Great, and of Nabonidus, was still, unlike Nineveh, a prosperous and important center. Like the Egyptians, the Babylonians weren't greatly concerned at a change of rule to Macedonian from Persian. The temple of Bel Marduk was in ruins, a quarry for building material, but the tradition of the Chaldean priests still lingered, and Alexander promised to restore the building. Thence he marched on to Susa, once the chief city of the vanquished and forgotten Elamites, and now the Persian capital. He went on to Persepolis, where, as the climax of a drunken carouse, he burnt down the great palace of the King of Kings. This, he afterwards declared, was the revenge of Greece for the burning of Athens by Xerxes.